We go through cycles where presidents are trying to minimize our military involvement. Either it's we're after a war, certain presidents are just less comfortable with American force. But certainly, you know, President Obama was trying to reduce our military presence overseas, but he didn't want to be seen as soft on defense. So this is one way you can do that. You can say, well, hey, we are using these special operations forces, but again, as you mentioned, they're less expensive, they're less controversial. Again, keeping them out of the public eye can be valuable. Then we start to get this notion that maybe special operations forces don't count as boots on the ground. And there's a mixture, certainly. Some of it is political self-interest. Some of it, you know, there's rational explanations for why you'd want to keep these things secret, because there may be some diplomatic advantage.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 13th, 2017. It's been a long, long week with a lot of news to digest as the fallout from the firing of FBI Director James Comey continues to settle. Here in the Lawfare Podcast, we're doing you a favor and giving you 40 precious minutes during which you can take a break from all that. So sit down, relax, and take a listen to Jack Goldsmith interviewing Mark Moyer at the Hoover Book Soiree on Moyer's new book, Oppose Any Foe: The Rise of America's Special Operations Forces. The book is the first comprehensive history of U.S. Special Operations Forces, and Jack's interview provides an illuminating window into the nature and functioning of this often hidden world. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 224, The Rise of America's Special Operations Forces.
So when President Obama came into office and he had pledged to end President Bush's heavy footprint warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it soon became apparent that he replaced it with what came to be known as a light footprint approach to counterterrorism. And I think it's fair to say that the light footprint approach has three elements. One is the use of drones, UAVs, or at least air fire from a distance. Two is the rise and importance of cyber, offensive cyber weapons and offensive cyber operations. And the third is the use, or the heavier use, of special operations forces. And the third is what we're talking about tonight, special operations forces. Mark has written a book called Oppose Any Foe: The Rise of America's Special Operations Forces. And it's the definitive history of special operations forces. They didn't actually begin after 9/11. So we're going to talk about that history a little bit, because the book really starts from the beginning, but we're going to focus mostly on contemporary issues. So why don't you just start off by telling us, what are special operations forces? What do they do? How do they fit into the military? How do they fit into our counterterrorism strategy? Give us the kind of brief overview.
Great. Thanks. Thank you, Jack. And thanks, Benjamin and Mike Frank and Hoover, for hosting this great event. It's great to be here. And thanks to all of you for coming to attend this. To start off, I mean, one of the things that you find is that most people know something about special operations forces, but few people actually really know the details outside of the special operations world. So each of the services has special operations forces. The first one I'll mention gets confused the most is the Army Special Forces. So a lot of times people confuse that with special operations forces, which or SOF, and that's the umbrella term that covers all of these organizations. Now, within the Army, you've got not just the special forces, but you are also known as the Green Berets. You've got the Rangers. You have Delta Force. You have the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. The Navy has the SEALs. They have special boat units. Marine Corps has MARSOC, which is now known as the Raiders. The Air Force has a number of air commando units. And then to further complicate matters, there's also something called JSOC, which is falls under SOF, but it's sort of a special, particularly elite unit, and that is, the main elements of that are Delta Force and SEAL Team 6. And so the book is, one of the things it does is lets you understand how these things all actually came about, because one of the reasons I wrote this is simply most Americans really don't know that much about this, and most of what they know is post 9/11. And if you read this, you'll kind of see how they came about. A lot of these units were disbanded at one point and then reconstituted oftentimes as something else.
So what's happening on, let's just start in the early history. I'm going to call the early history pre-9/11. So what is the demand for special operations forces? What do they do that's, that the conventional military forces don't or can't do? What was the impulse to create these units?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, up until 9/11, you actually have a deficit of things for special operations forces to do. They're trying to find things to do, whereas since 9/11, there's been more than they can possibly handle. So for most of the time up to 9/11, it's them trying to find missions to do and constantly having to reinvent themselves. The first units come about in World War II, and most of them are not created because somebody sat down and said, we've got this particular need that we need to fill. It was actually for other reasons. So the Marine Corps Raiders were formed in 1942 because President Roosevelt's son had heard about this guy named Evans Carlson, or he knew this guy who was a sort of an apostle of Mao Zedong, but he was in the military, and they thought it'd be cool to form these commando units. And the Marine Corps Commandant actually said, this is a terrible idea, we don't need these. But the President listened to his son, who was a young Marine officer, so don't think the President's listening to relatives is anything new. So that gets formed. Then the Army Rangers come into existence soon thereafter, because the United States at that time is trying to find ways to partner up with the British, and the British have these commando units that they're using for a raiding strategy. So we form the Rangers for that. Now, the Rangers, and there's a couple other units, initially the idea is that they're going to be doing these swift elite raids in various theaters. But by the time they're formed, in a lot of places, they can't actually do these because they've come up against tough enemies that are just too big and powerful. In fact, the Ranger units, two of their entire battalions get wiped out in Italy because they're outmatched by the Germans. And so the Rangers and the Raiders get disbanded. The one unit that survives World War II are the Navy Frogmen, because they were actually formed for a particular mission, which is to go in and clear the path for amphibious landing forces. But they fall out, and then again we go through in the subsequent history. There's again a Raider-type experiment in Korea that doesn't go as well as people wanted.
One of the themes early on is there's a consistent demand and need to form these units. A lot of it's for hostage situations as well, and yet not a lot of success. Mm-hmm. And even up into the later period in the 1980 attempt to rescue the hostages in mm-hmm. Iran, the Somalia experience in the 1990s, these were special operations missions. Mm-hmm. The failures there weren't necessarily their fault, but there's a persistent demand for these units, even though they're not chalking up a lot of successes to that point. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the 70s is where the hostage rescue mission comes on. But again, there's not too many hostage situations you have to deal with. But then they also look towards doing other types of raids. But yeah, the Desert One debacle was really a watershed moment, because
this was the Iran mission.
Yes, this was Iran, 1980.
Why don't you just, some people in the room weren't born then, so why don't you just remind people? I was born then.
Yeah, so Jimmy Carter, you know, these hostages are taken.
This is a very serious consequential event in American history, yeah. But it's not terribly known these days.
Right, yeah. So, and originally Carter thinks he can use diplomacy to renegotiate the return of these hostages, but over time that seems less and less likely. So the military comes up with this plan to send in the newly constituted Delta Force, along with some other forces, to go in and raid. Now, what happens on the mission is that they never even get to Tehran, because they assign 8 helicopters to this mission, thinking that they only need 6. So if something happens to 2 of them, they can still go. Well, it turns out 3 of them break down, and so they have to abort the mission in the desert, and then on their way out, there's this crash, and 8 people get killed. So it's a big disaster. And this, ironically, is actually a boon for special operations forces in that it creates the impetus for new resources and authorities. So after that, you have JSOC being formed, and you have aircraft who are dedicated just to special operations rather than what you saw in Desert Storm, or Desert One, excuse me, where you had all these aircraft just brought in ad hoc from other places.
And then the momentum builds in the 90s, but they really come into their own after 9/11. So just, and I'm sorry asking you some more thematic questions, but just run us through the high points of that history, which I take it are Afghanistan, the use of special forces, especially in Iraq, and I take it the bin Laden raid, 3 of the high
points? Yes. Well, so in 2001, President Bush is trying to find things to do against the Taliban before we can mobilize our big military forces to go in great strength. So the CIA sends some folks over very early, and then soon thereafter, the Army Special Forces are asked to send some people over. And I think sometimes we think this was a mission that was very well thought out in advance, but actually the Special Forces, when they went in, had no Afghan language capability because they never thought they were going to go to Afghanistan.
In fact, they didn't want to go in at first, didn't they? Well, they were asked, and there was hesitation.
Yeah, there was a lot of wrangling over who was going to do what. But what the capability they brought that was really crucial was laser acquisition targeting, so they could use precision munitions to hit Taliban positions together with the Northern Alliance. And so this is probably the case more than any other where you could say special operations forces had a strategic impact pretty much by themselves. So, again, a lot of this owes to the Northern Alliance, but together with the Northern Alliance, they destroyed the Taliban. So this is a huge boost for the special forces in particular, other parts of SOF less involved. But then we get to Donald Rumsfeld comes in, like a lot of politicians, he knows nothing about special operations forces, but he starts to hear about JSOC and thinks
he likes the idea.
Yes, and so the idea of global manhunting, it really gets going with him, and so there's this effort to develop the capability to go after Al Qaeda in all these different countries, and it actually turns out to be very difficult, foreshadowing later problems. That
to say a little bit more about what you mean about going after Al Qaeda. Just to give us an illustration of what that involves.
Well, at the time, they knew, I think, at least 20 countries there were al-Qaeda operatives running around. This is 2002. And so the idea was you could either go capture them and interrogate them or kill them or do something. But what they figured out is that the State Department didn't like letting these military guys in all these countries, and that's a problem we've seen continuing today. So it was actually very hard for them to do much except in Afghanistan and Iraq. So General McChrystal comes in as commander of JSOC and really revolutionizes the manhunting capabilities there. And this is only possible because of what happens in information technology. You suddenly have all these people using computers and cell phones, not really knowing that American Big Brother's listening in on them. And so you've got this huge upsurge in manhunting capability that is used in Iraq, really unprecedented surgical strike capability, and causes great damage.
What are the numbers per? Is it?
It gets up to It was 10 raids per month when he came, and it got up to 300 per month, so 10 per night, which is really astonishing. I mean, if you look in Vietnam where we tried to do something like this, it was almost impossible to get the information to do that.
That was one of the striking things: is the intelligence collection aspect got very sophisticated, getting their computers, their telephones, downloading the information, and using it, if not in real time, to go after their friends or colleagues the next day. And that's one of the things that enabled them to generate the speed.
Yeah, that's right. And so you would actually think, a lot of people thought this would just decapitate the insurgency. And starting with when they got Saddam Hussein, people thought, well, get rid of Saddam and his sons. But it turns out the insurgents actually are able to withstand these very severe drubbings. And it takes U.S. conventional forces coming in ultimately in 2007, because they are needed to hold ground. You can kill lots of insurgents, but if you can't hold ground, then generally you're not going to succeed. And the same thing happened in Afghanistan.
And with the bin Laden raid, as you point out, that was a successful operation, but it didn't lead to a lot of progress in the war against al-Qaeda and associates in any event.
Right. I mean, al-Qaeda was able to, they've developed a deep bench. Bin Laden certainly had attributes that no one else could possess, but al-Qaeda hasn't gone away. They've been able to thrive. I mean, they'd already by that time sent people out in a lot of different countries, so they have a lot of franchises that are successful, including ISIS, which broke off from them. But also that raid created this backlash in Pakistan, where since we didn't inform them, they kicked all of our special operators out who were actually there to do counterinsurgency. They shut down our drone base. I think Pakistan, it's actually faded from the news, but it's a place where I think we need to be continuously vigilant.
So this leads finally to one of the critical themes of the book, and that is, and I thought it was a surprising claim, not because I disagree with it, but because I'm surprised anyone disagrees with it. And the claim is, and you should explain what this means, that special operations forces can be tactically very successful, but for strategic ends, they're not terribly useful. So there are a lot of short-term, small successes, but they're not leading to progress in the war, is one way of putting that. Could you flesh that out and tell us why you think that?
Yeah, so I mean, when they start off, they're very small in World War II, and everyone understands that they are just a tactical instrument, part of a much larger enterprise. The idea that they can be a strategic instrument starts to take off with the creation of SOCOM, and the first real test of this is in Somalia in 1993. You may recall, we had a large Marine presence there, but they pulled out in 93, but we still had this bothersome guy named Idid who was interfering with our efforts to nation build. You know, we had very ambitious plans for building a state in Somalia. And so they were trying to find a way to get rid of this threat. And there were certainly some at the time who were arguing, if we bring a Delta Force with decapitation strike, we can sort of solve this strategic problem of ID and these militiamen. So they go in there to do that. Now, most of you probably seen Black Hawk Down or read the book. That's what ultimately happens. And you could argue, had we kept pushing, you know, after the raid that doesn't go so well, we push Special Operations Force, say, hey, we need to keep going. We actually have killed a bunch of bad guys in this raid, and we need to go after ID. But President Clinton was sort of mortified by the image of Americans dragged through the streets, and so we pull out. And as a result of that, and the clear lesson for most people is that the SOF have been oversold. You can't just go in with a raid and take out ID'd. And so that idea really fades, but it comes back after 2001 when we see the special forces helping overthrow the Taliban. And I think, again, you know, you have to look at the specific conditions. I think that was a peculiar moment in time. And you know, we tend to, a lot of times, take so much credit for ourselves when, in most cases, it depends a lot more on who the local actors are. And if you actually look in Afghanistan, shortly after the Taliban's overthrown, we try to use special operators with a different group of local militias at a place called Tora Bora, and those militias let us down. And so you see a bit of a fallout, but I think we've continued to see this idea of a strategic actor. And the light footprint you mentioned at the beginning, there were certainly some who were saying, 2009, 2011, you know, the Iraq-Afghanistan big wars are not really necessary. With these special operations and drones, we can actually keep these problems at manageable levels. I personally think that turned out to be a huge mistake, because when we pulled out quickly of Iraq, we saw things collapse, and Afghanistan, the pullout happened again at a pace faster than the military wanted, and we saw a lot of the gains evaporate.
So just so everybody understands, explain what you mean by Special Operations Force not being able to achieve strategic success. I think I know what you mean, but I just want to make sure everybody else does.
Yeah, so the concept, again, put in its more extreme form, is that essentially Special Operations Forces can achieve the strategic objectives of the United States without conventional military forces taking part. You know, clearly they can make some contribution to the strategic enterprise, and tactics lead towards strategic ends. But the theory really has been that special operations forces can actually do this without the conventional forces. And this, of course, has not gone over well with the conventional forces. But again, I think there's still, we hear some of that. And of course, too, a lot of this gets entangled in budget battles, and so special operators are, like any other part of the government, are trying to show how important they are and why they deserve money more than someone else.
But the criticism after Somalia is basically, I think, one of the criticisms in your book, which is they aren't all that they're built up to be. They can't do what we hope they can do.
Right. Well, certainly in
terms of, some people hope they can do.
Yeah, certainly strategically. I mean, there's also the question of, can they even achieve tactical success? And they
but
have
you need to explain better. What you mean by tactical and strategic.
Yep.
I still don't understand quite.
So tactical success would be simply winning whatever battle or completing whichever raid they are sent on. In the case of Somalia, they went on a raid. It wasn't for Idid himself, but they went after someone else. And because his helicopter gets shot down, we end up suffering 97 casualties. You could say that operation at least detained some people we wanted. But the larger strategic objective of bringing stability to Somalia clearly fails because we are forced to leave. Again, special operations are generally quite good tactically, but a lot of times the situations they're put in are just so difficult. Desert One being another example where the situation was just so tough that even the best people we sent were not able to complete the mission.
And yet, another theme of the book is how presidents going back to FDR, JFK, through certainly the last couple of presidents, have relied very heavily on special operations forces. They romanticize them, you say. They rely on them more heavily than they should, and they continue to be attracted by their capabilities. Mm-hmm. And you think too attracted by their capabilities. I've got some theories about why presidents do that, but what explains, that's a puzzle, isn't it? If they're really not obviously tactically successful and can't be strategically successful, why are we relying on them? Why are they continually lured by them?
Well, I think it's, to a large extent, the same reason that Americans more broadly are. We are fascinated by these elite units, and some of them have been able to be very effective in showing the trials that they have to go through. I mean, the Navy SEAL Hell Week has become a great ad campaign for the SEALs. And so people, we have the finest military in the world, and these are people who are, among the best within that great military. So I think there's simply part of that comes from this respect for the elite military. I think there's also been, in popular culture, stories that romanticize them. If you remember Rambo, he used to be a Green Beret. Certainly the Bin Laden raid did great things. There was also actually before the first ones, or shortly before the first special operations reform, there was a movie about Rogers Rangers, who, in fact, if you saw in that, someone just put something in the Wall Street Journal saying, well, Rogers Rangers were a special operations force. Well, the thing about Rogers Rangers, though, they were actually came into existence before 1776, and Rogers sided with the British, so it's a little bit of a difficult issue. But that's, again, there's this romantic notion that these are, to some extent, almost superhuman figures, and that's where you can get in trouble, because then presidents start to think these guys can do anything when, again, they're great, but they are only human.
But isn't another element of it that they're stealthiness and their tiny footprint? So presidents, for the same reasons presidents are attracted to covert operations, although most special operations aren't covert operations, but isn't part of it that they can achieve serious consequences and help tactically, if not strategically, without anybody knowing about it, without it being on the front page, without having a big footprint, with fewer casualties, perhaps, because mm-hmm. with much less expense? Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem crazy, especially in modern times. Well, it depends on what we're accomplishing, but isn't that the main attraction?
That
you can achieve things and keep it off the front pages, and it's less expensive, and there's less publicity.
I think that's certainly been important for some presidents. And again, we go through cycles where presidents are trying to minimize our military involvement. Either we're after a war, certain presidents are just less comfortable with American force. But certainly, President Obama was trying to reduce our military presence overseas, but he didn't want to be seen as soft on defense. So this is one way you can do that. You can say, well, hey, we are using these special operations forces, but again, as you mentioned, they're less expensive, they're less controversial. Again, keeping them out of the public eye can be valuable. Lyndon Johnson in 1964 uses them because he wants to hit North Vietnam, but he doesn't want people to know about it because he's actually running as a peace candidate. We saw in Syria, President Obama sending special operations forces without the public knowing. And then there's an interesting distinction that's made there, too, because we were told there are no boots on the ground. Then we start to get this notion that maybe special operations forces don't count as boots on the ground. And there's a mixture, certainly. Some of it is political self-interest. Some of it, there's rational explanations for why you'd want to keep these things secret because there may be some diplomatic advantage.
So in terms of secrecy, as an outside observer trying to figure out what Special Operations Forces do, it seems to me that they're more secretive than their equivalent in the Central Intelligence Agency. Title 50, Offensive Operations, I feel like I know more about through leaks and public testimony and reporting. I feel like I know more about what the Central Intelligence Agency is doing than I do about what JSOC is doing. And I know that the Central Intelligence Agency's reporting requirements are much more robust for their oversight committees than for the Armed Services Committees. So they're really this remarkably, they are remarkably secretive. We still, your book is amazing, but we still don't know a lot about their missions.
Yes, and certainly they have not been subjected to the same congressional scrutiny. When they were formed when SOCOM was formed in 1986, Congress was in love with Special Operations Forces, and they've largely continued that for a long time. There wasn't this distrust that you had between Congress and the intelligence community. And it's not really till you get to about 2014 when SOF is trying to expand it into new realms that suddenly Congress finally takes a real stance on this. But again, historically there hasn't been a scrutiny, and I think in some senses it makes sense to keep things secret. You don't want your operational procedures to get out, but at the same time it inhibits the internal professional discourse that you would have in most professional fields. And I worked as a Special Operations Command for several years, and you can clearly see a lot of what they will do is classified, but when things are in the classified realm, they very rarely reach enough people to really get a discussion going. So I do think there is a need for more open conversation on a lot of these issues.
And you describe in the book, especially after the Bin Laden raid, this is my phrase, not yours, but almost like Special Operations got too big for their britches. That first of all, there was a lot of leaking by individuals about what was going on. Second of all, their relations vis-a-vis Congress, you call it the McRaven overreach, I think. Mm-hmm. Would you tell us about that? And the response, you talked about it a little bit.
Yes, well, there was so much adulation that came after the Bin Laden raid. You've probably seen some of the videos of people claiming to be the guy who killed Bin Laden. I think one of them just published a book too. But it kind of went to their heads, and this has been a problem, I think, in other cases, and special operators get accused of this, partly again just because they're so elite, sometimes it goes to their head a little bit. But they, Admiral McRaven wanted to expand his authority, and this has been an ongoing source of concern, where although SOCOM gave Special Operations a 4-star headquarters, the troops were still under the authority of these regional commanders, like the Central Command commander, for example. So Admiral McRaven was interested in increasing his authority over these units. He also set up this office in D.C., the SOCOM National Capital Region. He did a lot of these things without informing Congress, and when Congress found out about them, they started to get upset. And the people that were in charge of this had come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, where I think that they figured you could do what you want if you're in JSOC, essentially. And there's an adage they often use, which was, it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. So they basically went around and started doing lots of things and blew off Congress. And so Congress finally got sick of this and reminded SOCOM that they actually control the money. And so in the book I detail how eventually Congress reasserted its authority. It cut out some programs that Admiral McRaven had wanted. And so it was a bit of a humbling experience for SOCOM. And I think McRaven actually did get some of the reforms he was looking for. But I think the idea of SOCOM becoming much more powerful really got shot down as a result of that.
And yet, still enormously heavy reliance. Another theme in the book is just the number of deployments. And one of the things I wasn't as well aware of was just what a devastating impact it's having on the members of Special Operations Force. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In fact, General Thomas and the acting ASD SOLA, Teresa Whalen, just yesterday were talking to Congress about this, and they said how these unending deployments are taking this psychological toll, high rates of suicide, substance abuse. So again, I think we we became over-reliant on them. If you look at just how many deployments they've been doing, even the, and these are a lot of the toughest Americans, but you know, they themselves have their breaking point. And so the leaders of special operations who normally are very eager to get missions are actually saying, and this has been too much. I think the phrase is, well, we're eating our young, is what Teresa Whelan said. So we need, I think, to be more realistic about what these forces can do. We have seen some signs out of the administration that they're starting to fix this, because we've been using Marines in Syria, for example. The airborne are doing things in Somalia. But you can't be on a constant wartime footing doing wartime pace indefinitely without these kinds of problems.
So I'm going to switch topics just a little bit and then ask a final question. Switching the topics a little bit, and I don't know if you can answer this because I don't remember reading about this in the book. But one of the things that was notable was how well Special Operations Force got at mining, collecting and mining intelligence in real time, to using digital means especially, and using that information to help them in their. But you didn't talk much, and I don't know if this is because you can't talk about it or because there's nothing to say, so I'll just ask it. Mm-hmm. How are they using cyber weapons at all? I mean, are they, I don't think of Special Operations Forces as using offensive cyber weapons in any way, maybe for intelligence purposes, but maybe for attack purposes. Mm-hmm. So that's the question. Is that part of their mission? And part of their tools, I should say.
Yeah, they've had some role. I'm a bit removed from this now, but as I understand it, a few years ago, there was certainly, when cyber became a big thing, everyone was kind of trying to jump into cyber, and SOCOM included. I think what they have figured out is that the real cyber warriors, who are sort of nerdy computer guys, are not the kind of people who are going to be in special operations forces. And so there's certain niche capabilities they can play, but
Those big brawny guys can't do computer programming. Is that what you're saying?
That's not their core competency. Right. Now maybe sneaking in to do something, I think as far as I'm aware, I don't think they're going to be playing a central role in that.
But I'm talking about as a tool. It's just not obvious that they're using it heavily as a tool. Mm. Okay, so let me give you a wrap up question. So the book, I would say, is sympathetic and empathetic. It's an empathetic account of Special Operations Forces, but also quite critical of their capabilities, critical of where they are now. They're being overused. We have a romanticized sense of what they can do. They're burned out. They're getting cocky. Some of their leaders are tyrannical and maybe not necessarily rule followers. And yet there's this incessant demand for them, and presidents rely on them. So what is your, just in the counterterrorism context, what is your vision for how they should operate? What would a proper use of Special Operations Forces be?
Yeah, well, the first point I would make is that it would not be a good idea to keep expanding them. Both Bush and Obama expanded them quite dramatically. We went from 38,000 in 2001 to at least 70,000 today. Again, partly because we thought they could do all these great things. But at the same time, we've been shrinking the rest of the military. And for one thing, if you keep getting bigger, you're going to become less and less elite. But also, that comes at a cost to the conventional forces. And I think, right now it seems like conventional warfare is, a thing of the past. But we've seen these big wars come up on us. And so you can't just simply forget about the conventional wars. In terms of what Special Operations Forces should do, I mean, they've continued to do some of these surgical strike missions in various places, and that's a capability I think certainly worth doing. There's a question of, do we really want to do this with very low-level people? That's been an ongoing concern. But I think it's also a skill that you can apply elsewhere. I mean, we've just heard, again, people in Congress talking about you may need to use these guys to go in and seize some rogue regime's nuclear weapons. There's also the, this is another confusing term in special operations, but unconventional warfare is what they tend to call the support of resistance groups. But this is something that certainly seems applicable. I mean, we're doing it in places like Syria already, but there's also other countries where, given where the world is now, we may need to do that. So that's a capability to keep. And then also counterinsurgency, which is closely related to that mission is something worth keeping, because again, even though we may not want another counterinsurgency, we're going to do it. And so maintaining your language skills, your cultural skills are very important. And a lot of what's being done and will continue to be doing is what we now call capacity building, which is mainly training and education of our foreign allies. And in the book, I go into some...
Why don't you just say a few words about that? Because that was the biggest black box for me, and I learned just because I think most of what they do is training and education. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just look at the whole 75,000, mm-hmm. I think more than half of them are actually engaged, or at least a good number of them. So why don't you just in closing say what that piece is?
Yeah, in the book I kind of summarize it. If you're really interested, I wrote three monographs for JSOU, Joint Special Operations University. But the key points, what I would say is this started with the Kennedy period, but it was done very... on a very ad hoc basis, and a lot of it's been short term, a lot of times 6-week courses where you go in and train someone and leave. We have,
but they're training them in special operations.
Not necessarily. Okay. Sometimes they do. That's an interesting question too, is because do you want to create elite units? And I argue usually you don't, because these countries need more than elite units to do things in a lot of cases. But what we found too is these short term missions don't really have lasting value, because for one thing, it's just not a lot of time to learn a skill. But a lot of the problems we see in these countries is not just skills, but it's sort of cultural attitudes, and you need to a prolonged, persistent presence. And this is something we've learned that SOCOM has certainly learned in the last few years. But Colombia is probably the best example of where we had this long presence, and you build, you know, the most important change is generational. Because the biggest problems are cultural.
All right. Thank you. It's a great book. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Hoover Institution for hosting the event and providing audio. As ever, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. We don't advertise or promote, and we rely on your support to spread the word. If you want to support what we do at Lawfare, please do give the podcast a rating and review in the iTunes store. As always, thanks for listening.